This is Talking to America. I'm your host, Aaron Zellman. Our show today is about gun control equals people control. We have an expert in that area. He's Bill Tonzo, retired University of Evansville sociology professor. He has written quite a bit about these issues on the social, critical, and deep political aspects of the gun issue. His recent book is what we'll be talking about today. It's called Gun Control Equals People Control. And it's a collection of 11 of his gun issue essays that have been originally published over the past 20 years in such periodicals as Reason, Liberty Chronicles, and Gun Week. Well, Bill, to begin with, why don't we tell people how to get the book, and then we can get into all the fun stuff.
You can get it through the publisher, Author House. That's spelled one word, at authorhouse.com, or you can call them at toll-free 888-280-7715. And from Author House, it's $11.50 plus postage. And you can also order it through any of the major bookstores, Borders, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, and so on, or Amazon. There it'll run probably around $13.50.
All right. Now we got the business out of the way. Now we can have some fun.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me, what prompted you to reach back over a 20-year period and pull these particular articles and essays out and put them together under one cover and within your book, Gun Control Equals People Control?
Well, I've been writing about the gun issue since about 1969. I had done my PhD dissertation on not on gun control, but on the interest in firearms. And that sort of got me writing on the subject. Long about the late 70s, early 80s, I started doing some social critical stuff on it, including a lot of letters to the editors of local newspapers and so on. But of those essays that I wrote, as I look back over them, some of them were sort of my favorites, and it sort of seemed that if I didn't pay attention to publication dates and just hooked them together in a certain way, that they sort of flowed one to the other, and connected some aspects of the media treatment of the gun issue, popular cultural treatment of the gun issue, and people control, sort of tied them all together. And these were things that were very seldom touched on by scholars dealing with the issue, and never touched on by the media. And so I just thought that that would make a nice collection. And as far as the way that it's set up, I've got three media essays in the first part of the book, two popular culture ones in the second part. Third part has four people control essays, and then there are a couple of satires that constitute the fourth part of the book.
Okay. Let's look a little deeper into this. What really prompted you to write these particular articles and essays?
Well, I was exasperated at the treatment that the gun issue had received over the years. I'm an old codger, and I was born in 1933, and so...
That makes you ancient, doesn't it?
That makes me ancient, yes.
Okay.
And that also puts me back in a world that a lot of people now don't realize ever existed, when guns were accepted. The big push for gun controls in the 1930s peaked before I was aware of what was going on around me. And so by the time I came along, or at least I was aware of the larger world, World War II was on, and there was no concern for gun controls. I mean, guns were good during World War II. And so in the world I grew up in, guns were ubiquitous. And I was born and raised in Herron, Illinois. It's a little... it was, at that time, a mining town in the far southern part of the state. I always say the part with trees and hills. And it had been a very wild place. It made Tombstone look rather tame in the 1920s. By the time I came along in the 30s, it was very peaceful. But there were guns all over the place. And my dad had a lot of guns. Almost all of our male friends and relatives had guns. And some of the earliest memories I had were dealing with guns, and so I was very tied in with the American gun culture from the beginning. By the time I was 12, I had fired Colt single action Army 45, a government Model 45, a German Luger, even a 30 caliber carbine that my Navy officer uncle brought up on leave one time. And so guns were just, part of my world, my everyday activity, and so on. And I got really exasperated with the media treatment of the issue and some of the nonsense that you read about guns and the media, such as, you know, Saturday night specials that are somehow rather devastating in the hands of criminals and completely useless to honest folks trying to defend themselves against criminals. So this sort of thing just now and again would provoke me to sit down and write something, and these are essays are the result of that exasperation.
You know, I think some of our listeners who have not been around that many years would just really like to know what it was like in the good old days, if we can call it that, before the push for gun control was revived in the 1960s.
It was so easy to get guns. I mean, we hear nowadays that we have a high crime rate, and of course the homicide rate has been going down for a number of years. But even now, it's just getting down to the point where it was prior to the passage of the Gun Control Act of 1968. Actually, the homicide rate was lower before the passage of that act. And before that act, you could purchase firearms through the mail. There were no federal restrictions, at least, on age, you know, the purchase of firearms. You could order not only shotguns and rifles, so-called sporting arms, but handguns from Sears Roebuck, Montgomery Ward. You could even get guns, surplus military guns. We also hear that apparently we're not supposed to have, civilians aren't supposed to have anything military. But you used to be able to very easily get surplus military guns, not only through various importers and so on that would bring over Mausers and Enfields and so on from other parts of the world, and American guns, but you could get them from the federal government through the Army's Office of the Director of Civilian Marksmanship. You could buy M1 carbines, you could buy 1911 45s, 1917 Enfields, just about anything through the DCM for prices that were, of course, inflation has run these up considerably, but in those days you could get them, oh, 45 or M1 carbine for about $20, I think it was, in the middle 1960s, and 45s for about the same thing. You could get even 20-millimeter German anti-tank rifles. A friend of mine had one that I was able to fire. These things were huge. They were semi-automatic even. You could buy them through the mail without any sort of ID or background check or anything else. And I saw one. I was looking up some of these things last night. I saw one. I think it was a Finnish 20-millimeter anti-tank rifle that could be had for something like $99 and some cents. So the guns were very, very easy to get. A letter to the editor, a local paper responding to some anti-gun story, a fellow pointed out that he had bought his first pistol, a 9-millimeter German Luger, at age 16 through the mail. So, again, this is surely was a time when guns were all over the place and no one thought anything about how easy you could get them or anything else.
You're listening to Talking to America with our guest, William Tonzo. Here once again is your host, Aaron Zellman.
I think some people would like to know if you can give us some examples of the acceptance of guns and how it was manifested through the public at large.
Well, the display of them, you know, we hear so much nowadays, oh, my gosh, a gun. You know, and a kid in school can get into trouble even by, you know, pointing his finger at someone else and going bang, bang. But in those days, when my folks and I would go shooting, we'd in a small town, about 10,000, lived about three blocks from the edge of town in the mining area. And that's where we would go shooting. And we'd carry our guns right down the middle of the street. And those guns could be, for the most part, they were 22 rifles and pistols. But now and again, they would be, you know, 45 1911s or 1917 30-06 Enfields or whatever. And we'd just walk right down the middle of the street with them, and it was no big issue. And you'd see other people going hunting, you know, carrying their shotguns down the middle of the street. And there was no problem in flyover country, that is. And even I understand that, though I wasn't there, that the kids in like New York would, who were on rifle teams could carry their target rifles in the subways without causing a heck of a lot of ruckus, no ruckus. I had an acquaintance of mine was telling me that when he was in grade school now, he once took his 22 rifle, I think he had gotten for a birthday, to school with him because he was going hunting afterwards, and the teacher allowed him to keep it in the cloakroom. There were, I had a friend over at, attended SIU Carbondale, Southern Illinois University, back when it was a small school, you know, 2,500 students when I started in 1951, and 4,500 when I graduated 4 years later. But anyway, in those days, it wasn't uncommon at all for male students to have guns in their dormitory rooms at the University of Evansville, where I taught. That wouldn't have gone over very well. A friend of mine had two 22 rifles and a single-barrel shotgun, single shot, suspended from his walls, dormitory walls, as decoration. The head resident knew about them, and there was no issue whatsoever. Our Air Force ROTC rifle team I was on had its range in the attic of the main classroom building. And one of the place in town, New Era Dairy, that at the time sold the biggest milkshakes, had a sort of curio counter that you could buy what we now call Saturday night specials for about, I guess, $19 or something like that. No check on anything. I was in the Air Force out in Montana. These little radar stations stuck out in the boonies. And I was on I belonged to a gun club in Miles City, Montana. And it had its range right in the second floor of a building in the middle of the business district. And one evening after we'd been shooting, three friends and I went across the street to a restaurant, and while we were there, we decided to compare our handguns, and we took them right out in the middle of the restaurant, and no one gave us a second look. So these are the kinds of things. I mean, simply, guns were we could have just as well been comparing cameras or wristwatches, you know, in that restaurant, and it wouldn't have been any different. I mean, guns were just so accepted at that time.
Well, as you say, it is a very different world. Why is it that the mainstream media is so anti-self-defense and anti-gun?
I guess that what you could say is it during World War II, it wasn't that way. Guns were accepted. Obviously, the good guys had guns, the bad guys had guns, but we had to have, you know, guns to protect ourselves from the bad guys and so on. But after the war, particularly, not just after the war, actually, go through to about the late 1950s, early 1960s, you get to the point where we had all the civil disturbances, obviously the assassination of President Kennedy, and we had the riots in the cities and everything else. And before, early 60s, they had the whole concern about delinquency and delinquents of Saturday night specials and so on. And it goes back to what had, you know, previously existed before World War II. Well, guns were associated with crime, and they were so negative. I think also depends on you know, where the media folks come from, and several studies have pointed out that many of the gatekeepers of the major media come from either the east or west coast or the northern industrial, you know, city belt. A lot of these people have had no experience with firearms themselves. You find some, obviously, the Tom Brokaws and others who come from places like South Dakota and so on, who do come from a flyover country and have been exposed to guns some. But these guys aren't the typical ones. They're the ones who have gone off to the cities to make their you know, careers. And they also are quick to pick up the ways of the folks they're moving in with. And they're going to find out that and they're going to grow, quote unquote. And growing means accepting the cosmopolitan ways of the city folks. And so you get to the point where they work with certain assumptions that guns are basically, particularly handguns, are basically troublesome apart from the folks who use them or misuse them. Other places have done, other countries, they hear, they understand, they don't question, have supposedly done something about guns through gun control, and they sort of feel, too, that the public opinion polls tell them that over here everybody wants to do the same thing, but they are thwarted by the vested interests of the National Rifle Association and so on. So if you go into these, your work, you're reporting with these assumptions, and you recognize that these assumptions are those of your bosses and so on, and you're going to build your stories around these sorts of assumptions, and they become something that that aren't questioned. So it's just the, you might say, media culture, or you might say the cosmopolitan culture that is accepted in these circles. That sort of guides everything that these folks do.
Well, I assume you've confronted some of these mainstream media gatekeepers about their anti-gun bias. What kind of experience did you have?
Generally, they don't particularly care for it. One that I think you might be interested in hearing about, everybody that knows something about the issue knows that, and watched the coverage of the assault weapon controversy on TV, knows that often, particularly on NBC and CNN and maybe some of the other network, when any story was on about assault weapons, so-called semi-automatic assault weapons, full automatics would be demonstrated. So you get the impression that what we're talking about here is machine guns, and that opponents of the ban wanted to hunt with machine guns and so on. So after seeing these for several years, I finally got aggravated, and I called NBC in New York. And the first time that I called, a woman answered, and I told her what my gripe was. And she said in a sort of haughty way that, sir, we're no longer doing that. She didn't deny that they had done it, but she claimed that they weren't doing it any longer. And I told her that I had just seen one, and that pretty well stopped her, and she didn't have much to say after that. But it continued, so I called again a month or a few months later, and I got hold of a guy this time and told him what my gripe was. And he didn't say anything. He didn't respond at all. And I said, so I guess that, and I also told him that I'd called before. And I said, so I guess it doesn't do any good to complain to you guys. And he came back with, anybody can make a mistake. And I said, well, NBC has been making this mistake for 5 years now. And he hung up on me. And so I called him back, and I asked him for his name. And he says, I don't have to take this kind of abuse. And he hung up again. So I called the next day, and I asked to talk to a supervisor, and eventually got hold of a fellow, McCormick, I think his name was, in charge of broadcast standards. Say that's an oxymoron if there ever was one. But anyway, he was very friendly, but he explained the whole thing. He didn't apologize for the rudeness exhibited by his people. But he did claim that these mistakes were made primarily due to ignorance and also due to the rush to make, get on the air. And that they just pull some stock footage out and without paying much attention to what was on it and throw it on. I don't know that it could be accepted, given that NBC's when they use the pyrotechnic device to blow up GM trucks, and GM complained about it. And they complained once, and that was it, and there was an apology. But I never have heard of any apology from NBC or any of the other networks for misleading the American public on the assault weapon business.
You're listening to Talkin' to America with our guest, William Tanzo. Here once again is your host, Aaron Zellman.
Why would you say the intellectual community that you worked in for so many years is generally so anti-gun?
The these folks, they're word workers. They're experts. They think they know how to run the world. And we live in a world nowadays of where we're encouraged to believe the experts, various social scientists and so on. These guys have a whole lot of theories, and they quite often don't even agree with each other. If you're not familiar with psychological and sociological theory on, you know, how people work, how societies work, and so on. But they all think they know. And if you're an expert trying to rearrange the world out there, and a lot of these people believe that sort of a secular priesthood, that where the priest of old had God on their side, now these people have science on their side because of their study of nature and so on. And if you, if you're a world reorderer, you might find folks out there who sometimes don't want to go along with the plans that you have for them. And obviously, if those folks are armed, it's going to be rather difficult for you to get their cooperation.
Let's talk about the specific political functions of gun control.
I think that they've been neatly summed up, if I can find that here, by a fellow by the name of Raymond Kessler, who is trained both in law and sociology. And he claims that, one, gun control's increased citizen reliance on government, intolerance of increased police powers and abuse, two, help prevent opposition to government, three, facilitate repressive action by government and its allies, four, lessen the pressure for major or radical reform, and five, can be selectively enforced against those perceived to be a threat to government.
I guess what you're saying then is that efforts to control gun ownership in the United States have not all come from left-of-center people.
No. In fact, my argument is that on the one hand, you've got the business right, business-oriented right, has attempted to control labor, essentially, through gun control. You've got the left that has been, well, the modern new class, you might say, that wants to control the small-town rural folks who don't necessarily want to go along with their social engineering efforts and so on. But when you get on the right side, business, if you look back, for instance, with the control of machine guns, I think it was John Ellis in his Social History of the Machine Gun, he points out that they've been sort of used as an alternative to collective bargaining by National Guardsmen and company guards, you know, back in the early part of the 20th century. And there were the Ludlow massacre in Colorado and so on of the National Guardsmen machine gunning the tents of striking coal miners. And no one complained about machine gun usage in those days. You started getting complaints about them, and they were eventually, civilian ownership came under federal regulation in 1934. Supposedly, due to the fact that guys were using machine guns to rob banks and so on. But Neil Knox has pointed out that march on Washington, D.C., World War I veterans, and you had the march on the Ford plant in Dearborn, Michigan. And there was a lot of labor unrest and so on at that time. And he sort of suspects that the main reason that that law was passed was that the establishment, essentially the conservative establishment, was worried about, you know, rebellion, essentially, and the leftish takeover. So you had a lot of efforts along those lines to keep, you know, the downtrodden. And, of course, you can go back to the attempts after the Civil War in the South to keep blacks from getting guns. What we would now call Saturday Night Special legislation was then called suicide. They were then called suicide specials.
I guess the other thing I'd like to add to this is the 1968 Gun Control Act had the blessings of most major gun makers,
yeah.
American gun makers.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how many people fully realize that. You would think it's a little strange that American gun makers would like more gun control, but it was profitable for them to keep guns from coming in from out of the country.
Yeah, and
so,
also inexpensive guns that could compete with their better quality guns.
If only the guns were the same quality.
Mm.
All right, well, why don't we tell people we can get your book again? It's called Gun Control Equals People Control.
Either Author House through authorhouse.com, or by calling 888 280-780-7715. It's 1150 plus postage through the publisher, or you can get it through any of the major bookstores, either online or just through the bookstore itself or Amazon. Price generally runs around $13.50 if you go that route.
Well, Bill, I want to thank you very much for being on our show, Talking to America, today. I've been your host, Aaron Zellman. And please remember, if you won't defend your rights, don't complain when you lose them.
Opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily reflect those of JPFO.org or its members. Talking to America is a production of JPFO.org.